Hi. First things first, sorry about the audio quality. We're recording this on a little webcam microphone because the proper microphone did not come in time for recording. So don't anticipate this being a long-term issue, but I know it's annoying and tinny and weird sounding, so yeah, sorry about that. But anyway, on with the show. Welcome to the New America. This isn't a normal presidential transition. This isn't like the transition 4 years ago. This isn't even like the transition 8 years ago. The rules have changed. First of all, this is the first presidential transition since the Supreme Court ruled on Trump versus United States. So basically, for people that don't know what that ruling consisted of exactly, it said that the president has broad immunity for any action that could be considered part of an official act of being president of the United States. And then additionally, beyond that, he also has some unspecified, vague, greater immunity on things that aren't necessarily official acts as well. The entire decision is really, really vague, and it's really vague on purpose. Basically, what John Roberts and the other justices of the Supreme Court were trying to do when they crafted this decision was basically make it so that they can decide on an ad hoc basis, like what counts as an official act, what counts as immunity, what counts as not. So rather than leaving the power in the executive branch, it actually moves a lot of power to the Supreme Court itself. But regardless, the president now has a certain amount of immunity that they did not have as of 1 year ago. Now, second of all, both houses of Congress are majority Republican. It's not really the same Republican majority as it was in 2016. You know, both houses were Republican the first time Trump came into office as well. But I don't know if you remember, but the vast majority of Republicans in 2016 were actually opposed to Donald Trump. You know, they mocked his nomination, they mocked him throughout the entire election process, and didn't really coalesce around him until much later. So, yeah, this is a different kind of Republican majority. All of those people that were dissenting against Donald Trump, all of those people that were opposing Donald Trump's agenda, they're gone, right? Paul Ryan is gone. All of these people have left, or like Mitch McConnell, for instance, they're on their way out and they're kind of silenced by the new Republican establishment. And third of all, and maybe most importantly, this is Donald Trump's second term, right? There's no electoral consequences for anything that happens. So there's no legal route to where you can go vote at the ballot box, you know, and vote against Donald Trump. And he doesn't really strike me as someone that's terribly worried about the future of the Republican Party. You know, I don't think he cares about anything much at all beyond his own kind of political fortune. So, yeah, with that in mind, there's not really any electoral consequences for anything that happens. So, I mean, what does this mean? Like, why do these things combined make it so different? Well, you hear a lot about checks and balances. You know, our government has checks and balances between the legislative, the executive, the judicial, all of these systems in place that essentially, you know, prevent any branch from seizing a bunch of power at the expense of the other branches. But let's think about what those checks and balances on the presidency actually consist of, right? The three kind of checks on the power of the president are, first of all, impeachment, right? If he does something illegal, then he will be impeached by Congress, right? This is impossible as long as the majority of Congress supports him. The second check is that if he does something illegal and Congress doesn't impeach him, he can still be tried later on, criminally prosecuted for anything he does that's illegal. That's gone, right? That check is eliminated, basically. And then the third check is the ballot box, right? If the president does something unpopular, then people are going to vote against him. But that doesn't matter for Donald Trump either. So, yeah, this vague sense of checks and balances, this vague sense that, you know, it's all going to be fine because we have a robust constitutional system, that's really kind of gone out the window right now. So, yeah, I mean, this is a constitutional crisis. Like, there's not really any other way to put it besides that it's a constitutional crisis. But, you know, crisis doesn't mean that it's time to give up. It doesn't mean that we've lost. It doesn't mean that Donald Trump gets to do whatever he wants. It means that it's time to fight, you know, to organize, to stand up in ways large and small and say no to the repurposing of our government, right? Just because we're kind of denied a lot of the traditional legislative paths to political power doesn't mean that we don't have political power. It means that we have to find that power in other ways, you know, maybe through protest, through organization, through union action, through strike. there's plenty of other avenues where we can stand up to the people that are kind of taking over our government against our will. So yeah, our job for the next 4 years is to put up that resistance through any other avenue possible. And yeah, I mean, repurposing of our government is exactly what this is, right? You know, it's a government established, quote unquote, for the people, by the people. But now it's becoming one that pretty exclusively serves the interests of the few rather than the interests of the many. And who are those few? Well, maybe it's the Trump family, you know, policies that are specifically kind of designed to enrich them. Maybe it's policies that are designed to enrich just the billionaires that funded his campaign and decide his policy. Maybe it's the Heritage Foundation and other kind of right-wing think tanks, right-wing groups that have a set of restrictive moral standards that they want to force everybody to live by, you know, and that are being very openly supported by this administration. So, yeah, all of these groups kind of have a stranglehold on the government right now. And I can tell you exactly what nothing this government does is going to benefit, and that's working people, right? Normal American workers, right? Because when you have billions of dollars, when you're a billionaire, when you're a business owner like that, well, ordinary people, they're just something to exploit, to use, to throw away. So it's time for working people to come together, fight for each other, and claim the American dream for ourselves. You know, tell the healthcare executives and the oil barons and the tech billionaires and everyone else that wants to take our country away from us that we won't stand for it any longer. And the first step in our fight is having the right information. So this is Radio Free USA, coming to you from inside the ventilation ducts of the Oval Office, reporting the facts. Welcome to the show. So, given that it's a new administration, kind of, I thought a nice way of breaking down exactly what the priorities, what the policies of this administration are going to be, is to take a look at the cabinet, right? Because, like, Donald Trump is not, you know, sitting in the Oval Office deciding exactly what healthcare policy is going to be. You know, he doesn't know anything about healthcare policy, right? He's not making the day-to-day policy implementation decisions in all of these different areas of the government, right? The government's just way too big for any president anymore to be kind of that, like, sole administrator. So we'll just kind of go through cabinet appointment by cabinet appointment and talk about who these guys are who are tasked with implementing the Trump agenda. And we'll start from the least controversial kind of cabinet picks, you know, quote unquote, least controversial, going by how many votes they got in the Senate, basically. But a lot of the uncontroversial ones you'll see are quite interesting. And then we'll finish up with the more controversial choices, the choices that kind of barely squeaked through and might indicate something a little more extreme than people even necessarily realize. So let's start with the CIA, right? John Ratcliffe, chosen to head of the CIA, gets 74 votes in the Senate, right? A lot of Democrats supporting John Ratcliffe here. He was the director of national intelligence in 2020. Kind of most famously, what he did in 2020 is there was a bunch of Russian intelligence that was collected in 2016 about Democratic candidates, right? This intelligence was collected by Russian agencies to try and discredit these candidates because Russia was, of course, very interested in Republicans winning in the 2016 election. So the veracity of this information, completely in question, right? It's just, we know that Russia collected this info. We haven't verified it. In fact, a lot of it does seem to be, you know, just have no evidence behind it at all. And he releases this information to the public in 2020, despite it being, you know, potentially nonsense. And like the only people's word that we have on it, you know, being accurate at all is just Russian spy agencies. So that's what he's kind of famous for coming in. As for what's happened so far with the CIA, I think they've offered buyouts to every single employee, which, you know, it's like, I'm no fan of the CIA. You know, like the CIA has done innumerable terrible things in, I've got to say, over 100 other countries in the last, you know, like since World War II, basically, since America became kind of its imperial self. But it still doesn't strike me as necessarily like a good or a stable thing to do for the U.S. government to, you know, offer to buy out every single person that works at the CIA. I really don't see how that kind of benefits the American project in any way. But that's John Ratcliffe. You know, we'll keep an eye on kind of what happens with the CIA, although the thing about the CIA is that you tend to find out everything you need to know about what happened like 30 years later or maybe never. So I don't know, maybe this is the last we'll ever hear about what the CIA kind of gets up to under John Ratcliffe. You know, if you work for the CIA, feel free to reach out. You know, like, we're always happy to kind of maintain your anonymity. You know, we're very curious what's happening, like, inside these government offices, basically. So, yeah, don't hesitate to reach out to the program. But again, probably don't use your government email, because I think in that case you'll probably get in a load of trouble. All right, moving on. Department of State, right? This is the textbook uncontroversial pick, right? Marco Rubio selected as Secretary of State. He gets 99 votes in the Senate. You know, life is good for Marco Rubio. Everybody loves him. He used to be, of course, a sort of rival to Donald Trump, right? Running against him in the 2016 race, gets nicknamed Lil Marco. Sort of represents that old establishment Republican Party, right? So theoretically, he's a moderate, but as we've seen, there are no, like, true moderates in this administration, and we can see that just from what the State Department has done so far, right? USAID has been totally dismantled. It seems like they're trying to fire everybody, but about 300 people at the entire USAID division. USAID, of course, a very, very important program for kind of projecting American power abroad, right? Like, I've seen a lot of conservatives over the past kind of week suggesting that spending this money on people in other countries was some kind of, like, altruistic, pointless action by the government, that we were helping people elsewhere when we could have been helping people here. That's not really what USAID is. Like, this is all very much for the benefit of the United States, especially with, like, kind of our geopolitical chess match that we're having with China, right? They've got the Belt and Road Initiative. We've got USAID and, like, I guess, like, IMF-style programs, basically, to try and court these, you know, developing countries in the global south into ending up, like, more aligned with us and less aligned with China. So, yeah, dismantling USAID obviously just kind of pushes everybody into China's lap a little bit more. So, no, this isn't just a matter of, like, oh, we're not helping poor people in other countries anymore, although that's certainly true. There's a lot of people that are just going to die because USAID isn't going to give them the help that they need anymore. But this also is just really detrimental to, you know, the United States maintaining its global authority. And the other thing with the USAID breakdown is just the amount of misinformation. It's just totally ridiculous. Basically, the formula is that if the truth is complicated and the lie is simple, then you just tell the lie, and people aren't going to be able to take the time to sort through all of the muck and figure out what the truth is. So, like, classic example of that is this Politico situation, right? People claiming that USAID gave millions of dollars to Politico, which, first of all, was not true. USAID gave, like, $80,000 to Politico. The entire government gave something like $8 million to Politico. This was for Politico Pro subscriptions, right? Politico Pro is something that's used by, you know, governments, by businesses, by anybody, as, like, essentially, like, a policy-making, like, lookup platform, right? It's like LexisNexis, or, like, a really sophisticated Microsoft Office for lawmakers, basically. It's obviously something that's reasonable for a government to be spending money on, and it's an expensive program because it's very sophisticated and they have a pretty small user base for it. So, no, Politico is not being used as some kind of, like, Marxist, you know, not that Politico is Marxist, obviously, but people were claiming that it was, like, a Marxist kind of propaganda machine for the Democrats. Or that, like, Chelsea Clinton was being paid millions of dollars by USAID, when USAID was actually just giving some money to the Clinton Foundation, which was doing charity work abroad. None of that money made its way to Chelsea Clinton. She's, like, on the board of directors but receives no compensation. So, yeah, I mean, that's been the biggest thing out of the State Department. But we've also seen, like, just some really weird kind of vibes, I guess, coming from what Marco Rubio's been doing and saying. And to me, the weirdest of those is the El Salvador situation, right? So El Salvador, run by Bukele, they had a serious gang problem, but now they have, I guess, kind of a serious Bukele problem. In order to deal with the gang situation in El Salvador, he needs, like, a massive, like, $100+ million loan from, I don't remember if it was the IMF or just another international agency. And so his legislature doesn't want to pass it, so he just marches a bunch of guards in there and essentially, at gunpoint, forces the legislature to pass it. He's forced the Supreme Court to grant him additional terms. He's like a tin pot dictator, right? Like more than 1% of their population, including thousands of children, are now in jail. A lot of those people never had any kind of due process of law, anything like that. And this is the country that Marco Rubio is really like, you know, like thanking for trying to, you know, like court the United States for prisoner lockup, right? Like Bukele was saying that he would take U.S. prisoners in his prisons, you know, for a nominal fee. You know, his prisons, of course, not having any sort of respect for human rights. So, yeah, like, so far, the quote-unquote moderate Rubio State Department is just kind of cozied up to this, like, totally insane tin pot dictator in the third world. Yeah, and, like, his whole claim to fame right now, I guess, Bukele, is reducing the homicide numbers in El Salvador. But they don't count mass graves, and they don't count deaths by police, they don't count deaths in custody, and also they won't allow any international verifier to, like, check their numbers. So this whole crackdown, you know, massive human rights violation in El Salvador might just have no results, for all we know. But these are the guys we're cozying up to now. The other thing that we've done very recently is we've sanctioned the International Criminal Court by placing financial and travel restrictions on anyone that cooperates with an ICC investigation of the U.S. or its allies. And by its allies, of course, we mean Israel. This is the second time that Donald Trump has sanctioned the ICC. The first time was because they investigated United States war crimes in Afghanistan, right? So this investigation happens in 2020. So we sanction the ICC. They end up, like, shuttering the investigation, basically, to try and, like, preserve some kind of global authority, basically. We committed, like, war crimes in Afghanistan. I don't think there's really any question that those were committed. So, yeah, this is the second time that, you know, the U.S. State Department is trying to essentially shutter the ICC when it very legitimately kind of goes after the United States for some of its more unsavory actions around the globe. Yeah, and then also one more note on Rubio's State Department. His undersecretary, this undersecretary Beatty for public diplomacy, is just a white nationalist, right? He's like tweeting about how we need competent white men in charge of our government. He was actually fired from the Trump administration last time around because he spoke at this H.L. Mencken club with a bunch of white supremacists. So this is the kind of guy that's being hired into the, you know, quote unquote moderate State Department, you know, into a position of authority. And it's just a great indicator of, like, these people that were too extreme for kind of Trump one are finding a very, very happy home in Trump 2, which is another great indicator that this is not the same Trump administration. This is something different, basically. All right, enough about the State Department. Let's move on. Maybe the most kind of actually uncontroversial pick is Veteran Affairs. Doug Collins from Georgia gets the Veteran Affairs pick, 77 votes in the Senate. He doesn't really seem, like, overly qualified to run Veterans Affairs, but he seemed to answer the questions very, very well during his hearing, so people weren't too concerned about that. The biggest thing going on with the VA is basically what we call, like, starving the beast, basically. So Republicans don't like the VA very much, so they defund the VA, you know, make sure it doesn't have the resources that it needs to properly take care of veterans, and then they can claim that the VA is being poorly run because it doesn't have as many resources as it needs. And then they can say that the only way to take care of veterans is to get them private care. So it's the same thing that we're seeing kind of done with the USPS right now. Like, if you've noticed, the mail is bad lately. The mail is bad on purpose, right? Republicans are trying to make sure that the mail is bad so that they can try and push more of the mail towards private entities. But yeah, like, Doug Collins, very much just kind of business as usual for Republicans with the VA, you know. It's a bit of a sacred cow, you know, veteran care. Like, any party that kind of doesn't stand by giving veterans the care they need is going to just get wiped out in the elections, you know, like everybody loves veterans. It's just a matter of, do we give them care through the VA or do we push them into this private healthcare system that we all know and love? All right, education. Linda McMahon, I don't know if she's actually been confirmed yet. I don't think it matters because the Department of Education, you know, per Elon Musk, doesn't exist anymore. kind of unclear, like, how true that is. Like, the thing about everything that's kind of been going on with Elon Musk over the past week and a half or so is that, like, it's going to take months and months for the legal fallout of it to, like, figure out what what has actually happened. But they've definitely, like, ransacked the Department of Education, and like, there were a bunch of Democratic Congress people, like, out in front of it that weren't allowed to go in the building. But, yeah, they want to get rid of the Department of Education. And they want school choice, basically. So what they want is for people that don't send their kids to public school to either not have to pay any sort of taxes towards the public school system, or they want to give people basically like vouchers so that they can go to private schools instead of public schools. There's a couple of fundamental kind of motivations for this. One of them is just like that people don't like paying taxes. So rich people that send their kids to rich private schools don't want to pay for public schools. So simple as that. The other reason is that people want to send their kids to kind of Christian schools, you know, like Christian programs that maybe are not going to teach your kid, you know, about other sexual orientations, maybe aren't going to teach your kid about evolution, right? Just kind of an alternative faith-based schooling that they want supported by the government. So those are kind of the fundamental motivations for getting rid of the Department of Education. That, and they just, I guess, don't want to spend money subsidizing school programs that currently are, you know, having a lot of trouble getting students through. All right, moving on to interior. Doug Burgum is in charge of the interior. This is kind of like a spoil system posting right here. Doug Burgum, of course, kind of bent the knee to Donald Trump after primarying very briefly in this election cycle. But basically, he's got six edicts that they've already put out in the Department of the Interior, and it's kind of exactly what you would expect. They want to identify as many resources to maximize kind of land exploitation as possible. They've set out like an edict to prevent anyone rank and file at the Department of the Interior from opposing Trump's executive orders opening up more drilling. They want to review all climate policies that might be increasing cost of living and remove as many as possible, which, spoiler alert, like, kind of definitionally, climate policies do increase cost of living, right? That doesn't mean that they aren't necessary. That doesn't mean they aren't intelligent policy. But of course, they're going to increase cost of living, you know, in the short term, right? Like, you're trying to keep kind of like cheap resources like oil and gas in the ground because burning them turns out to have really, really negative long-term effects. So yeah, this is just your typical short-sighted like climate denial kind of stuff. They want to open up the outer continental shelf for drilling. This is like the most protected ocean ecosystem in the US. Like almost all of our protected ocean is this outer continental shelf. And just worth noting, like, why do we need to be protecting lots and lots of ocean? Well, the statistic that kind of alarms me more so than any other climate statistic maybe is that since 1900, like, the population of large fish in the ocean has dropped by over 90%, right? So we're just talking about like any fish that's like, I think, bigger than like 2 or 3 feet, you know, so like literally thousands and thousands of fish species just being wiped out to tiny, tiny versions of their prior populations. And that has, of course, like a cataclysmic impact on the rest of the ocean ecosystem, right? So yeah, like the ocean ecosystems are like on the verge of total collapse. And like, here we are, trying to eliminate like our little bit of protected ocean land, basically. Yeah, and the fifth edict is to eliminate 10 regulations for each new one introduced, which feels very kindergarten to me. Like, I don't understand why you would make policy like this. Like all these little kitschy, like, you have to remove two if you want to add, like, it all just feels really stupid. Like, why would you not just add the regulations that you feel like should be added and remove the ones that you feel like should be removed? Like, 10 to 1, you know, is this some kind of like natural law of the universe that like 10 need to go for every, I don't understand it. It just feels dumb, I guess. And then the sixth one is to try and open up a lot of Alaska for drilling, which has kind of like the three-part problem of that it results in like a ton more carbon emissions. It's like, it causes all sorts of like kind of breakdowns in relations with the Inuit people that subsist off of land in Alaska that we want to open up to drilling. And then, of course, also there's just kind of vast preserved natural ecosystems there. You know, there's like, you know, talk about like Gates of the Wild Gates of the Arctic, excuse me, national park. It's the biggest national park in the country, right? It's like hundreds of thousands of square miles of protected land that they just kind of want to eliminate. So yeah, I mean, that's what the uncontroversial Department of the Interior Secretary Doug Burgum is getting up to. And again, uncontroversial, right? 79 votes in the Senate. So that's 26 Democrats kind of hopping on board with that agenda in one way or another. All right, now for like a weird one, right? Sean Duffy, Department of Transportation, it's 77 votes in the Senate. As far as I can tell, I don't see how he's done anything with transportation before in his life. I could be missing that. I don't know. I mean, like especially transportation. I mean, I don't know if Pete Buttigieg had done anything transportation specific before either. It's just kind of like you just kind of put a guy in that department, it seems like. But regardless, like what we've heard out of Sean Duffy's Department of Transportation so far is that they want to prioritize areas for transportation development that have high birth and marriage rates. So just looking at the United States statistics on that, that's South Dakota, Utah, Alaska, and Nebraska that have the highest birth and marriage rates. Now this begs the question, why? Like, why? Like, I've never heard of this. Like, in my entire life, I don't think I've ever seen any kind of transportation or transportation-adjacent policy that had anything to do with looking at the birth and marriage rates in the region. Obviously, the four states I listed are not the states that are in the most dire need of increased public transport. Like, there's like eight people that live in three of those states, and then the fourth one is Utah. I'm not opposed, of course, to public transport being developed in those states. You know, I would love to see more public transport developed across the entire country. It's just a really weird thing to prioritize. So, yeah, mostly just weirded out by Sean Duffy. All right, Treasury. We got Scott Bessent, 68 votes. They haven't done much yet. I just want to note here, Department of the Treasury, of course, is the one that kind of got ransacked by Elon Musk first. Very worrying situation, right? So Bessent claims that Elon Musk has like just read-only access to the entire government payment system. But of course, Elon Musk claimed on Twitter, you know, maybe he was lying, maybe he was exaggerating to make himself seem more important. But he was saying that they were already shutting down payments that were going out to sources that they didn't like. And he was claiming that I think Treasury Department employees that were approving congressionally designated funds to things he didn't like were quote unquote breaking the law. So he's trying to intimidate Treasury Department employees into not doing their jobs. Yeah, so now like a judge has blocked all of that and demanded that Elon Musk, you know, like I guess delete all the data that they got out of the Treasury Department. Which I mean, I guess like what's going to happen if they don't delete it? Like, who's gonna step in and say like, now you're going to jail? Like, basically there's no consequences for any of this. They just totally got away with it, and I'm really not ready to believe that they just have read-only access to all of that anyway. But the other thing I want to specifically note about what's happened with the Treasury Department is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Right, so this is basically just a thing that was set up in the Treasury Department, and its whole job is just to protect consumers from being defrauded by companies without even realizing it. So, like, currently, the CFPB was suing Walmart for basically, like, illegally accessing and potentially changing employees' direct deposits. Capital One, which stole $2 billion in interest from employees per the lawsuit. And then also Zelle, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase for basically failing to do their due diligence and preventing like this widespread Zelle fraud from happening. So that's shut down now. And then also like the Labor Protection Bureau is semi shut down. Like basically they have three people on their little board and they need all three to have a quorum to make decisions. So they just fired one of them. So now they can't make decisions anymore. And the immediate effect of that is that Whole Foods workers won a union like 2 weeks ago, and now Whole Foods says they're just not gonna honor that union because nobody's gonna make them. So that's the effect of this administration on working people, is like even if you win a union, you're just not gonna get to have your union anymore because there's no one there to enforce it. All right, Lee Zeldin, in charge of the EPA. 56 votes. Yeah. So now we're kind of in the realm of people that are a little bit more controversially chosen, right? People that are just almost a party line vote on getting in. So Lee Zeldin already kind of trying to fire 1,100 EPA employees. He tells Congress during his congressional kind of approval hearings that climate change is an issue that needs to be addressed, and then immediately goes on Breitbart News, like, after getting the job, and just does a complete 180 on that, says that, like, climate change exists, but it's not something that anybody needs to worry about. Because of course he does, right? So he's kind of parroting, like, the typical Trump talking points. Everybody wants clean air and clean water and energy dominance, while kind of ignoring any issue that, you know, might be potentially more complicated than that. You know, clean air, clean water is something people understand very easily. The long-term ramifications of climate change, less so. All right. Homeland Security. Kristi Noem, who killed her dog. It just feels, like, worth re-mentioning that she killed, like, a puppy because it wasn't, like, she was trying to train it, and it wasn't good at it. Like, it wasn't good at, like, birding or whatever that it was supposed to be doing. And so she just got a shotgun, and she just killed the dog. I guess we don't know. Like, we're just trusting her word on this because this was in her book. It could be made up, I guess. But I wouldn't make up that I killed my dog. So, like, she's in charge of a lot of this, like, immigration enforcement type stuff. The only, like, real change in policy I think we've seen so far on immigration is, there's 350,000 Venezuelans that are sheltering here in the United States that have, like, legal asylum. These are not undocumented illegal immigrants. It's just people that are legally here, kind of fleeing the Maduro regime. And we've revoked their legal status. So these, like, 350,000 people, like, we're just going to, I think, in 2 months, ship them back to Venezuela, where they're, of course, going to face all sorts of retribution, I guess, from the Maduro regime, because that's what happens when you flee, you know, for a foreign country and then have to come back, is you're going to face retribution on top of all of the hardships that are already just going on in Venezuela. So that's just really rough to see. It feels like a totally vindictive policy. But it's exactly that sort of vindictive policy that's, like, the entire, modus operandi for Noem so far. Because, like, the long and short of it so far has been, like, what we're going to call, like, the immigration enforcement show, right? Like, the deportation show. We're not deporting more people than we were before so far. This mass deportation thing isn't happening. But Homeland Security is trying to make it seem like it's happening. So what we get is them changing the timestamps on every single ICE announcement since, like, 2006. This is all reporting from The Guardian on this. They changed all the timestamps to the last 2 weeks so that when you look up, like, ICE deportation, you're going to get, like, thousands of hits from very recently. But these are raids that happened in 08, in 2010, in 2012, just being made to seem like they're happening now. Then you get things like they're calling Kristi Noem, like, cosplay Barbie, right? Because she's kind of, like, on the ground with ICE, like, just wearing all of these ridiculous outfits, like wearing the bulletproof vests or, like, in a cowboy hat riding a horse with Border Patrol, just trying to make herself, like, visible as being, like, out and about with immigration enforcement, even though immigration enforcement is not really heightened yet. Dr. Phil was also out and about kind of, like, putting ICE raids on TV. I think the ICE raid that Dr. Phil was, like, a part of in Chicago was, it seemed like just exactly the kind of ICE raid that we've seen under Biden, under Obama, under every president, basically, except with the added macabre element of that Dr. Phil was there, which is really just a horrifying thing, I think, for anybody to see. But yeah, so far, not a lot of policy, but a lot of, like, just this vicious kind of, like, vaudeville show of attacking, you know, people that, I guess, like, look a certain way, I guess is how I'd put it. All right. Pete Hegseth. Pete Hegseth is in charge of the Department of Defense. Why is he qualified? Because he was in the military once upon a time, and then he was on Fox News for a much longer time. Now, has he ever run anything in the military? Not really. So he doesn't really, like, have any experience running an organization like the Department of Defense, and he has just a whole lot of dirty laundry. First of all, he has Jerusalem cross and Deus Vult tattoos on his body. Now, those are used by legitimate Christian sects. They're also used by hate groups, like as like a symbol that they kind of endorse the Crusades and maybe want to see like a modern day crusade. Hegseth claims that he's in the first group and doesn't want the modern day crusade. His book, of course, is called American Crusade. So kind of up to you whether you believe him or not. He had a sexual assault allegation that he just paid a settlement on to make it go away. His own mother called him an abuser of women. He's a known alcoholic. Probably don't want a known alcoholic running the Department of Defense, but he claimed in his Senate hearings that he would never touch a drink again if he was nominated Department of or Secretary of Defense. So if any of you know any alcoholics, you know, that's very believable, right? You know, like if you get a good job, then you'll probably just stop the drinking, you know, no complications there at all, no difficulties there. He also just doesn't really know anything about the U.S. military, I guess. So like they were asking him questions about like the ASEAN, like this Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is like Vietnam and Thailand and just a bunch of countries that we're kind of like allied with. It's like important for countering China. He couldn't even say what it was. And that's just one example of like his whole hearing was like this. It was just a lot of just not knowing what's going on. He also said in his book that we shouldn't abide by the Geneva Conventions. I don't know. I like the Geneva Conventions. Like, I really think we should not be, you know, like hurting civilians or POWs or whoever else. Like, I think they're a good set of rules, you know, hot take. I would like to see us follow them. And he also didn't say that he wouldn't deploy the military against US civilians. He just kept dodging the question. So that's a little worrying, you know, as a US civilian. All right, but that's Pete Hegseth. Next up is Pam Bondi, who runs the Department of Justice now. She's Attorney General. Now, why is Pam Bondi the Attorney General? Well, here's one potential reason, right? She was the Attorney General of Florida, and they were kind of deciding whether they were going to investigate Trump University for fraud, and she received a $25,000 illegal campaign donation from Donald Trump, and a few days later spontaneously decided not to investigate Trump University for fraud. Trump would end up paying like a $2,000 fine for making that $25,000 illegal campaign donation, which I guess in my mind just makes it a $27,000 illegal campaign donation with no other consequences. But regardless, yeah, she's here now. She's mostly just like exactly the loyalist that you would expect. She can't say that Trump lost the 2020 election, but she claims the Justice Department is going to be a nonpartisan, non-political organization. So, yeah. I don't know about you. I don't know if I believe her. All right, UN ambassador. I don't think Elise Stefanik is confirmed as the UN ambassador yet, but she's kind of famous right now for like the Israel issue. Basically, like she was the one that scalped all of those administrators of Ivy League schools for not being adequately pro-Israel. And now she's claiming that Israel has like a biblical right to the West Bank. And we're gonna apparently hear in the next month or so what Trump's official stance on Israel's ownership of the West Bank is, whether we're going to step away from our longstanding policy and like, you know, the entire world's longstanding policy of saying that no, Israel is illegally occupying the West Bank and that it is not their sovereign territory. So mostly expect her to just be involved in that kind of culture war stuff more so than like a more general role as UN ambassador. Office of Management and Budget. This is Russ Vought, 53 votes. Russ Vought, very famous for being one of the architects of Project 2025, which Donald Trump has never read and never heard of and certainly doesn't intend to implement any of, which is why one of the guys that created it is his Office of Management and Budget guy. Now, what has Russ Vought actually kind of done or indicated that he's going to do in the position? He was asked in his confirmation hearing whether he would commit to distributing congressionally approved funds. So basically, Congress controls the purse strings, right? Congress decides what gets funded and what doesn't. And then it's up to the executive branch to actually enact the wishes of Congress in distributing those funds. Russ Vought said he would not commit to doing it. Obviously, a little micro-constitutional crisis unto itself, just indicating that no, the executive branch is not interested in performing its function as stated. All right, energy. Chris Wright, CEO of like an energy concern, gets 59 votes in Congress, or in the Senate, excuse me. Yeah, he's like a big anti-climate change advocate. And like the way I would kind of describe the vibe with him is he's one of those like climate change is real, but it just doesn't matter guys, right? Because like if you just say climate change isn't real, then you're not an intellectually serious person anymore. So they've kind of retreated to climate change is real, but actually the best way to fight climate change is for us to drill more oil. And it's like Laffer curve type arguments where like in the long run, all the oil we drill will like launch us into the technological stratosphere and then we'll like solve climate change more easily. It's bullshit, right? It's like obviously bullshit. But that's kind of what they're peddling at this point. Yeah, he said the wildfires kind of out in LA over the past month or so have nothing to do with climate change, which is like not true. Climate change absolutely has made wildfires more frequent and much deadlier, much more severe out west. Kind of a great example of this is what's gone on with sequoia trees over the last like 10 or 15 years. Because sequoia trees need wildfires in order to function. Right, like they have those giant pine cones that they drop, and then those pine cones only open essentially in fiery conditions, and that's how new sequoia trees essentially take root. But sequoia trees, which of course very rarely were destroyed by fire, mature sequoia trees before 1970 or so, are now being destroyed en masse because the fires are more frequent and far more severe. So like 30% of all giant sequoias have been wiped out since 2016. Because of how many serious wildfires there have been. And of course, this is climate change. It's not a coincidence. It's just clearly due to, you know, conditions exacerbated by human influence. Yeah, he says there's no such thing as clean energy and dirty energy. I kind of agree with him on this. Like, there's just different scales of how dirty energy is. But the thing is, like, I'm not saying that because I want to kind of obfuscate the fact that some energies are better than others, right? Like, is solar energy clean? Not quite. Is nuclear energy clean? Not quite. They're a hell of a lot cleaner than any fossil fuel, though. And it would be really, really obstinate and obstructive and annoying for the Department of Energy to pretend like that's not the case. But that's exactly what we have now. Housing and urban development, we have Scott Turner, who didn't complete his FBI background check. Which is why he only got 55 votes. I don't really know what would be in Scott Turner's background to where he wouldn't complete his FBI background check. So I really don't know what's going on with that. I really, like, he hasn't really announced anything that he's going to do at all. But it's just worth noting. He just didn't do that part of the procedure that literally everybody always does. So that's weird. Commerce, we've got Howard Lutnick. He's the tariff guy, right? He's going to be kind of running all of the tariff business, which so far with the tariffs, nothing has happened. And the reason that nothing has happened is because Donald Trump knows that tariffs are kind of bad for consumers, right? Like there is like a narrow kind of economic use of tariffs where they make a lot of sense, right? Like if you have like a fledgling domestic industry that you want to make sure is protected from international competitors while it kind of establishes itself in that landscape, yeah, tariffs make a lot of sense in this situation. But even in that situation and in all situations, they hurt consumers, right? They make things more expensive for people that want to buy them. So yeah, tariffing Canada at 25%, tariffing Mexico at 25% would make consumer goods in the United States much more expensive, which is why Donald Trump didn't do it, right? He delayed the tariffs on Mexico and Canada. He placed a 10% tariff on China, but he didn't remove the exemption for packages under $800, right? So it's those smaller packages, those under $800 ones, people buying things from like Temu and, you know, these cheap Chinese retailers, those are not getting tariffed. And the reason is, again, because Donald Trump doesn't want everyday people to feel the negative effects that his policies kind of inevitably are going to bring. So, yeah, like the tariff business is just this game of like kind of brinkmanship where we're trying to, I guess, like threaten and blackmail our allies into acquiescing to whatever demands we have. But the thing about that game is that it's a very short-term game, right? Like, for now, Canada's pretty dependent on the United States, but I think Canada's probably looking at this situation and thinking, I would rather not be so dependent on the United States, so I'm going to start thinking about how to get out of that arrangement. So, yeah, I mean, like, watch for Canada, watch for Mexico, watch for these other countries to find some new trading friends. Because in the long run, I don't think the threaten and cajole kind of plan here is going to result in like a long-term economic benefit for the United States. All right. Health and Human Services. We've got Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who, of course, during a trial hearing, claimed that a worm ate part of his brain and then died in there. Like, it's funny, like, when you first hear it, like, haha, you know, like, a worm died in his brain, which is ridiculous. You know, of course, it's insane to say that. It's insane to pick up roadkill bears off the highway and then try to eat them. You know, these are things Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has done. But the reason he was claiming he had a worm in his brain is because he didn't want to pay alimony to his second wife. So he was trying to claim that he was, like, incapable of making money anymore because his brain didn't work because a worm died in it. And now he's going to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, right? He says that black people have stronger immune systems and thus would receive a different vaccine schedule than white people. I don't know. I've done a lot of reading on this. It's just not accurate at all. And I think most black doctors seem actually just very alarmed by this claim, which just on the face of it just seems really racist and potentially the foundation for some racist policy. His vaccine views have just no real backing, and that's why he's trying to shy away from them as much as possible. He claimed that he wasn't anti-vax whatsoever, he was just asking questions, but he's part of that, like, the, you know, directors of that nonprofit that was selling the vaxxed and unafraid, like, baby onesies. Also, he's, like, anti-fluoride in drinking water. People don't understand how bad people's teeth were before there was fluoride in the drinking water. Like, the reason that we started fluoridating the water is because of World War II recruitment. So the military went all over the place, you know, drafting for World War II. And what they were finding is that an unacceptably high number of Army recruits did not have enough teeth to chew their rations. And so they couldn't accept them into the military. So that's why we started fluoridating our water. And it immediately had just a tremendously positive effect on dental health, and we're not really seeing any evidence of the drawbacks that are supposedly there. Same note, like, raw milk, don't drink raw milk, like, it's not safe. If you want, like, high quality milk, you can get, like, the slow pasteurized milk, which it tastes the same as raw milk, actually, and is just completely safe. So I would recommend that. Seed oils, there's no negative, it's not real. It's not, don't fall for it, it's not real. It's just made up. Seed oils are totally safe in every way. They're not nutritionally harmful, besides just being fat. He claimed that COVID was engineered to kill Caucasians and black people while sparing the Chinese and Ashkenazi Jews. Which is, like, honestly, like, I think if I heard somebody on the street saying something like that, then, like, I would just assume that they should spend some time, like, you know, in, like, mental health treatment, right? It's just, like, a completely schizoid kind of claim. Like, I don't understand why he's going to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, you know? It's alarming. And in the meantime, the CDC has, like, a hush order where they're not allowed to communicate with us everyday Americans about what's going on, which is a little alarming because, like, you know, the bird flu is not an epidemic yet. It's not reached human-to-human transmission, but it's kind of festering, right? And at any moment, it could make that leap. So just something to be concerned about there, I guess. And again, if you work at the CDC and you want to get around that hush order, we will protect your anonymity if you have anything that you need to get out there. All right, intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. She's kind of a mess. Like, the biggest problem with Tulsi Gabbard is that there's a very plausible theory that she's, like, a little bit bought off by Russia. So, like, you know, she was in Syria when Assad was still in charge of Syria. And they were talking about the chemical weapons strikes, and the chemical weapons in Syria in some cases were dropped by airplanes. And she asks, honest to God, she asks if how we know that those chemical weapons were dropped by Assad and not by ISIS. Of course, the reason we know is because ISIS doesn't have airplanes. So we could just chalk that up to some sort of innocent misunderstanding. But then you've also got the biolab situation in Ukraine, where she's just parroting these Russian talking points over and over again, that we have these quote unquote biolabs in Ukraine that have potentially dangerous pathogens that we don't want Russia to get at. It's a little bit true. We did fund, some biological research in Ukraine. We do in hundreds of countries, I don't know about hundreds, tens of countries. And it doesn't affect things because they shut them down, and pack them up every time there's a war or anything. So it's just a matter of taking this very innocent, normal thing that happens all over the place and presenting it with this twist of sinisterness, right? That just happens to benefit Russia. So we could claim that Tulsi Gabbard is ignorant and maybe a bit of an idiot. And just stumbles into these Russian conspiracy theories over and over again. But if she's that much of an idiot, then maybe don't make her director of intelligence, right? Yeah. Anyway, Kash Patel, FBI. Kash Patel is crazy. he's a crazy guy. But first of all, just what the FBI is kind of up to right now before Kash Patel even completes his nomination process, which it kind of feels like he inevitably is going to now. They've already fired dozens of guys that were leading up these January 6th investigations, and now they're trying to purge, everybody that was involved with them overall. So you've got FBI agents that are suing to prevent the government from identifying and purging these lists of people. So the situation with the FBI is already a little bit crazy. But as for Cash, he's got his book series, The Plot Against the King, which is just this series of books where Donald Trump is the king of America and the sinister leftist cabal is trying to rig the election against him, but he's the king, so I don't even understand why there is an election against him anyway. But this is Kash Patel's little world, right? He's this is what he wants kids to think about the way America works, is that Donald Trump is the king. As for Patel's kind of background in law enforcement and, dealing with these sorts of issues rather than his series of children's books, the CIA tried to convince the Trump administration to investigate Patel for divulging state secrets to foreign agents. Trump administration declined last time around. He has an official enemy list that he created in his book Government Gangsters. It's exactly like you would expect. It's Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and just all these Democrats that are just enemies of the state. So that'd be a little worrying for your FBI director to have that. He claimed that the FBI orchestrated January 6th. The FBI just created that riot, which is a weird thing to do. And then of course, kind of most fringe and alarming is his connections to Stu Peters. Stu Peters is another schizoid conspiracy theorist guy. So Kash Patel was on Stu Peters' podcast 8 times. Who is Stu Peters? He was a bounty hunter who kind of had his bounty hunting career cut short because he kept impersonating police officers and then getting told off basically, forced to stop by local police departments. So then he kind of shifts to being a political podcaster and speaker. Basically, the Stu Peters routine is that he calls for somebody to be publicly executed. Fauci, Vernon Jones, those kind of people. He's a white supremacist. He's a flat earther. He believes in Pizzagate. He created the Jewish space laser conspiracy that later on we would see Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of buying into. He wanted Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce executed for supporting vaccines and witchcraft. He says Judaism is a death cult built on the blood of murdered babies. And that the Federal Reserve caused the submersible that was looking at the Titanic to explode so that it wouldn't find out what really happened. So it's not really shocking, I guess, that when Kash Patel was asked about Stu Peters, he pretended he had never met him. No, for his part, Stu Peters says that Kash Patel is lying about that, and that of course they know each other because he's been on his podcast 8 times. Like, it's, I don't know, I think if I went on a podcast 8 times, I would remember who hosted the podcast. So yeah, a little alarming to have, you know, the FBI prospective director just openly lying about his connection to extremists like Stu Peters. But yeah, that's kind of everybody so far that we've seen that's kind of important in this cabinet. We've got some other people like Secretary of Labor, Lori Chavez de Remer, is the nominee there. She's really interesting just because, like, she seems really pro-union, so kind of an odd pick. We'll kind of see how that checks out. A lot of Republicans don't seem to support her. But yeah, that kind of ends our cabinet breakdown for now. And we'll keep on kind of keeping an eye on these people as we talk through the news each week. But just a few odds and ends that didn't really fit into any particular cabinet members category here. Trump signed an executive order banning trans women from competing in women's sports, regardless of their hormone levels, regardless of like the whole system of tests that we were doing beforehand. The NCAA says this affects 10 people in the entire country. So a lot of people are kind of crowing about this massive victory. It's 10 people that you've now just said you can't play sports anymore. It doesn't really feel like some kind of the huge cultural transformation here. It's just a little bit of vindictiveness, I guess. And then a whole lot more vindictiveness. He signed an order that was going to force trans women in prisons to be housed with the male prison population, which is just obviously just a recipe for total humanitarian disaster. It's been stopped by a judge for now. And then 10,000 workers at King Soopers, which is a Kroger-owned grocery chain in Colorado, are striking right now because they think that Kroger is doing unfair surveillance practices and trying to cut their health benefits. So if you can, if you live in Colorado, maybe don't cross the picket line at those King Soopers locations. But yeah, just to wrap up, I guess my question about this whole administration so far is, like, what does this have to do with working people, you know? Like, Donald Trump comes into office on the back of the price of eggs, you know, and, like, the poor kind of Biden economy. And I don't disagree that the Biden economy was poor, you know? Like, I think one thing that really led to Democrats losing the election was just pretending like the economy was good, you know, when, like, obviously the signaling from the ground was that it very much wasn't. But how is any of this going to help? How is it going to help? Like, putting U.S. troops on the ground in Gaza, like, trying to own the Gaza Strip, you know, like, having a bunch of trade wars with our allies to make food and fuel more expensive, you know, like, pushing other countries away from trading with us, you know, like, deporting half of our farm workers. Like, how is that going to help working people, you know? Stripping away health protections, environmental protections, workplace safety protections, protections against fraud and abuse, the right to unionize, all of that. You know, like, we need those things, and having them stripped away is certainly not going to help working people. But coincidentally, all of these things sure do benefit the rich, you know, the rich and the powerful. And I don't think that's a coincidence, certainly. So, yeah, I mean, if you're worried about the direction of this administration and you don't have millions of dollars in an army of lobbyists, what can you do about it? Well, mostly you work together and organize, right? So, like, through organizing, through strike action, collective action, whatever else, we can exercise the will of the people. And I want this program to help kind of facilitate that organization. So if you're an organizer, or you know about an event, or you're planning on attending an event and you want to get the word out about it, then just shoot us an email at radiofreeusamail@proton.me, and we'll get the word out as widely as we can about it. And also in general, if you have any questions, topics you think need coverage, opinions about the broadcast, feedback, whatever else, you know, just reach out to us, radiofreeusamail@proton.me, and we'll try to respond on air. We're particularly interested in hearing from government employees, since you're on the ground where this is happening. You know, you're seeing the day-to-day effects of what's going on, and you're much more informed than the rest of us about it. So, yeah, please reach out to the program with any information that you have. And if you're worried about losing your job or facing reprisals for speaking out, you know, don't worry, we'll do everything we can to protect your anonymity. Don't reach out with your government email, though, because I think they're probably watching those by now. All right, and that's Radio Free USA. Signing off for today. We'll be back next Sunday and the next and every Sunday with news, discussion, and a whole lot more. Thanks for listening.